Welcome to episode 8 of season 2 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Friday the 3rd of July 2009, and in this week's episode we have a segment on laptop security and laptop theft.
News and events.
I'm going to do my command line segment without reading out the command line.
We're going to talk about Arduino hardware hacking.
And we're going to give away an Arduino and a book.
And we'll have our Joe at Ecosphere.
And we've got your feedback.
With me this week, in usual seats, is... Well, except Tony, who always stands up. I've never quite figured that out. Tony, hello, how are you?
I'm not too bad, how are you?
Yeah, all right. What have you been doing?
Oh, I've actually been doing some Ubuntu-related stuff.
Oh, my.
Nah, right, get out of it.
Yeah, our little Biglin NPC that we use to display our wiki notes on our secret wiki.
On a telly.
On the big TV in my front room. It was running the original Ubuntu that it was shipped with, and I got bored with it being so old and out of date and not working very well.
So now you wanted it to be more fun?
You must be the only person who was running Ubuntu. Yeah. I think everyone just wiped it.
Quite possibly. But I've now put Crunchbang on it.
Yay.
And upgraded that to Jaunty.
What?
And it's Crunchbang. Mm. It's the open box derivative.
You know, Phil Newber. You remember. Yeah. Keep update.
Yeah, season one. Simon's talked about it at least
twice.
But
you said in the intro that you've been doing some Ubuntu stuff. But
well, it's an Ubuntu derivative, isn't it? Ubuntu-related stuff.
Oh, so you've also been doing some Debian stuff.
Yep. And I also put Easy Peasy on my Acer Aspire.
Didn't you already have that on there?
Yeah, the new version.
Oh, okay.
Which I thought was going to be Jaunty-based.
Is that Netbook Remix?
It's Netbook Remix with a kernel that's got all the necessary bits in to do the wireless and stuff. I thought it was going to be Jaunty based because it was a new version, installed it, and it's still Intrepid, just shinier.
Oh.
And it's still nice, though.
Everything works?
Yes, as far as I can tell.
And everything works on the Biglin?
Yes.
I'm noticing a much higher resolution display, which is good.
I worked out how to get it to display at 96 dpi, which is useful if you're looking at it from the other side of the room, rather than 29 dpi.
You seriously need to get a wireless mouse, though, Tony, because me using the mouse here on a pillow with the cable stretched across the lounge isn't optimal.
Don't give away our secrets. I can find you a USB extender lead if you'd
like.
Hang
on. For the benefit of our listeners, we do actually have a proper studio. They're just making it sound like it's Tony's front room sat on his sofa.
Yeah, we're trying to be down with... Yeah.
Down with something.
Yes. So, Dave, hello.
God,
what have you been doing?
Dave finds microphone shopping.
Yeah, I've had quite an eventful week, to be honest. The other day, I thought, someone pointed out a usability bug to me, and I didn't come across it. They were printing stuff in things like Firefox and stuff like that, and it was coming out as PostScript, you know, .ps files.
But
no one uses...
not on the printer?
No, no, but when you print a file.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But people want them as PDFs. Everyone uses PDFs. No one uses PostScript anymore. And I thought, well, hang on. I'm so used to, when I print a file, changing it manually. And I thought...
Changing what manually?
Changing the option from PDF, so from PostScript to PDF.
So it's PostScript the default?
Yes, right, yeah. Okay. So I thought I'd look at changing the default. So I got the source out. But I did look for a bug first and didn't see anything on Launchpad. So I was going through, basically trying to find out where that dialogue was. So I got I got a load of source packages trying to find it.
Was it a little rabbit warren that you found yourself going through?
Didn't it feel like it? I mean, to be honest, the GNOME code base is actually really heavy, and just basically trying to find where stuff is, it's pretty hellish. But anyway, found it, and it was literally, a 2 or 3 line fix, yeah? I thought, yes. Okay, so I thought, well, actually, now I'll raise the bug, and then I'll apply a patch. Win.
Excellent.
Yeah, I submit the patch, yeah? And I come across that basically that is one of the blueprints for Karmic.
To fix that thing. Yeah.
And someone has already applied, it's already submitted my same patch. And I spent over an hour doing this.
Have we got a lesson we've learned there? Have we? Search on Launchpad first?
Clearly I did a poor job at searching, but yeah. I did have a go at searching, but I use PDF, PS, I can't remember what search term I use now. But
the wrong ones.
I clearly use the wrong search.
But the positive thing to take out of it is you've learned a bit about the GNOME code base, I guess.
Oh, yes, yeah, definitely. So I can bring some stuff forward from that. It's just a bit frustrating, the fact that I can't actually submit that. But something else I've been doing this week, I've been doing some Red Hat server stuff. And, God, I hate Red. I know this sounds like a bit of a shocker on a Ubuntu podcast. People say, you know, well, clearly I'm going to like this more than the other, you know, but...
No, Dave's opinion is not the opinion of this podcast.
Yeah, but anyway, I won't go into it, but Red Hat, for me, still suffers from dependency problems. It really does.
What a surprise.
Yeah. But anyway, that's me done.
Cool. Simon, what have you been up to?
I've been rather disloyal.
That's a shocker.
You've not been on another podcast, have you?
I've been on another podcast.
No, I feel like he's cheated on me.
Oh, well, there you go. Nothing to do with Linux. That's a good, it's a running podcast. So, yeah, went out for a...
Do they run alongside you with a mixer and microphone?
You can imagine Tony with his mixing desk.
Pull it along on a trolley behind you.
Tony and a microphone and headphones.
Did you just snort?
Yeah.
What the hell?
I do that.
No, I was just running behind the car and they had all the mixer gear in it.
Back, the boot opens.
That's right.
Leaning like out,
hanging out the back with the microphone. No, there's a couple of us ran out on Salisbury Plain for Solstice, and they recorded me, and yeah, it was good. You can go to
go on,
another website, amilewith.me.uk, and I'm on there, mile 29.
Oh,
so
nice.
Go and have a listen.
Excellent.
Yeah, something different.
Yeah,
it's really cool.
Yeah, it was fun. It was good. I've been thinking about it. Yeah, I planned to, actually.
Was this when you got up at 3 o'clock in the morning or something to go for the run?
Yeah, it was early.
Hang on. When we're recording, we get out of breath, just sat down talking, yeah? How the hell do you manage to... I mean, do you have, like, one word every 10 seconds? Welcome?
I think you'll find he's a bit more fitter.
It's called...
A bit more fitter? A bit fitter than
I. I'm a bit more fitterer.
Yes.
So I've been doing nothing really Linuxy.
That's good in a way,
isn't
it?
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. You did try Firefox. You were telling me about it, weren't you?
Oh, 3.5.
Yeah.
It's a browser.
Yeah, no, I think we'll talk more about this, but you tried to eat up all my bandwidth with Firefox.
Yes.
That's your fault.
Now we're contractually obliged to ask Alan what he's been doing. Alan?
And I actually have been doing Ubuntu things. So
excellent.
There, you've been doing Easy Peasy and Crunch Bang. Yep. Dave's been doing Red Hat. Simon's been doing a completely different podcast. I've been holding up the flag.
Okay.
And I've been trying out Karmic, which will be 9.10. And yep. I filed 5 bugs in it today.
Wow.
Mm.
So it's very buggy then.
Well, I think it's going to get worse, actually,
all right,
before it gets better, because there's lots of fundamental changes in the glue underneath that's going to cause people a bit of...
Glue that holds the distro together.
HAL, specifically.
Oh, right.
HAL's going away, which means that there'll be a period when stuff like USB sticks won't work.
That's going to break my 3G dongle, wouldn't it?
I think I was speaking to Chris Jones earlier, and he said Network Manager, Gnome Power Manager, and something else are all migrating away from HAL at the same time. So lots of things will break. But that's in Karmic, so that's development, so, you know, that's...
They've got a couple of months to fix it, haven't they?
Yeah, plenty of time. Yeah. I wanted to talk to you guys about laptop security. It's kind of, I know, so you say the word security, it's a really big thing. But the reason why it made me think of it is a couple of people I've spoken to recently have lost laptops. One of them, it was stolen, and he had no idea where it was until he got a phone call from someone he knew who happened to have been past the laptop, like third hand, and was asked to, you know, crack it and, you know, for the person.
Wow.
Opened it up and found this guy's details on it and was like, oh, I know him, and and contacted him, and there he's returning it, you know. So that's a good kind of good story, but there's a lesson there about the fact that he could get in and see the guy's data, so that's like worrying. But the other one was a guy who's got a laptop, and he had a service on there that online backed up his stuff, and he logged on after his laptop had been stolen. He logged on to the website and discovered that the laptop was still passing data and still backing itself up, like a month or three later on. And he also could see stuff like the emails that the new owner was sending, because that was all getting backed up as well. So he now knows where the laptop is. He's got the IP address and everything, and he's got the location, and he's given all this information to the police, and the police are trying to get a warrant to go around to the person's house. He actually knows where the person is and everything.
Yeah, but hang on. I mean, how did he actually find out from an IP address? I mean, the IP address is just...
As I said, he had the data. Emails. Yeah, he's got the data as well, not just the IP.
Oh, so like buying things from eBay or something like that, so he's got the eBay.
If you put your... But again, it's open and it's got data on it, and it's his data on it.
Well, just out of interest, what OS and distribution was that?
I think the first one was Linux. The second one was OS X.
Oh, okay.
So it applies to everyone. You know, you've got to think about, if your laptop's stolen, about two things, really, I wanted to talk about. A, recovery, getting it back. And the second thing is your data. What do you do about your data on there?
Well, the first thing that surprises me is that those laptops weren't just wiped. I always thought the first thing they did if somebody nicked a laptop was wipe the OS and install a new...
To be honest, I suspect that when a thief steals a laptop, they don't bother with that. They just sell it.
Yeah. The first thing is you want to get money for it.
Yeah.
Get rid of it.
Mm. I mean, it's probably... I'm imagining that the average laptop thief isn't a computer geek.
No. I suppose... I don't know. I guess if it was part of a bigger operation, maybe they're geared up for just blanking it and sticking Windows XP on it or something.
Actually, you sound like you've got a bit of a mission. We put a business together to do this.
Well, if it was passed to a shop, like a little computer shop, or it's a friend of a friend who I know he uses computers and he knows how to do it, then I can understand if that person makes a bit of a living, selling on knocked off laptops. Mm. Well, I can understand it. I don't condone it, but I can understand how someone could do that.
But
I'm sure the opportunist thief might just sell it on. For a bit of money.
But I mean that aside, what we really care about is us. We don't want to care about really how the thieves do their things. What we care about
were wiping it, it would wipe all your data, and your data would therefore not be in the hands of somebody else.
But if you're going to defeat the thief, you've got to think like the thief, they say. So first off, before we get into data, you've got to look after your hardware. How do you look after your hardware? Mm. Do we all walk around with nice big laptop bags that scream laptop and gadgets?
I seem to remember hearing from someone who was in the forces in the 70s that if you had something stolen from your locker, you got punished just as much as the thief for giving them the opportunity to do it.
When I worked in Wales, there was a policy in the office that was you absolutely must Kensington, the Kensington locks.
Yeah.
You must lock it to the desk.
Yeah, but they don't work.
Well, it stops the opportunist thief. That's someone just walking in and picking up a laptop and walking out. So, first thing is, secure the thing.
Yeah.
But if it's in your house and someone breaks a window and comes into your house, do you Kensington lock it in your house?
Get the shotgun out.
Do you put it in a safe in your house? No. And, people leave them on a desk or
on the train
or under the bed or wherever you keep.
Well, because it's not just thief; it's also losing. I mean, more than once, I've left my laptop under a chair and had to go back to get it, and luckily, it's still been there.
Is that under a chair in your house?
No. I mean, when I've been at conferences and things,
right?
You left it on a chair near me as well once, but only once.
Oh yeah,
never again.
Yeah, tell me about it. But yeah, so I mean, okay, so I mean, if we actually first look at like securing our data. Hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, to me, that falls into two parts. There's one thing about stopping other people getting it.
Yeah.
And the other one is to make sure it's backed up. Yeah. So basically, if you've got your stuff backed up, then it's no biggie to you because you can recover everything you've lost. Yeah. The other danger is that your data is then out in the world and someone can potentially rip off that information. There's a lot of valuable information on it.
So we've got in Ubuntu, and I mean other platforms have it as well, the ability to encrypt our data.
Mm.
So we could encrypt either the whole drive or just your home directory or just a portion of your home directory.
Yeah, like the private directory.
The thing we talked about with Dustin Kirkland.
Yeah.
That. So we have the option to do it, but in fact, if you use the live CD to install, which most people do, or you use Wubi, you can't do either of those.
Oh, yeah, because when I reinstalled...
the thing, but you can't fully encrypt.
When I reinstalled my Acer Aspire 1, I had got it all up to speed and lovely. I thought, now maybe I could really do with encrypting this drive just in case it does get nicked or I lose it or something. So then I asked Alan on IRC, what's the best method of encrypting my home directory? And he said, don't install from that, install from the command line version.
It's not...
great. How do you retrofit it?
To be fair, you can do it for your home directory because obviously if you have your home as a separate partition, you just unmount your home.
Which by default you don't with a live CD.
Yeah, you can do it with
the
live CD.
No, but what I'm saying is the masses.
Oh, yeah. We should be encouraging it,
The other thing is you can use third-party software like TrueCrypt, which I believe you can retrofit afterwards.
Yeah, it's a bit dodgy that, though, I
thought. Why is it?
Just the actual installation didn't feel... It didn't feel
natural. Cross-platform. Exactly. I mean, nothing cross-platform looks nice on Linux.
Firefox.
Well, the other one.
There are quite a lot of risks associated with getting your home directory nicked. I mean, it's potential, as we were talking before, about having emails. So that gives things like your address, potentially credit card details or passwords if you've had reminders and things sent in your email archive. You might have GPG keys. You might have SSH keys, which you would then need to revoke if your laptop was nicked. You might have photographs of
family pictures
and things, or perhaps less family pictures. any documents about work and stuff like that you may have written, documents concerning your work and things on your personal laptop to send in. And any of that goes missing, it's very valuable. If you could rely on a single system to protect that so that you wouldn't have to revoke all your SSH keys and your GPG keys and be sure of its security of your data, that would be fantastic.
If yours... Here's a question for you. if you encrypted either your home directory or the whole drive and your laptop was stolen, would you still revoke all your SSH keys and your GPG keys and change all your passwords?
Yes.
I'm not sure I would, actually. If I entrusted the encryption that much, I'm not sure I would.
Yeah, I'd quite happily revoke the SSH keys
because it's easy.
Because I have different ones on different hosts anyway. But your GPG, you only have one GPG identity, and it's a pain in the backside to revoke it and then get re-signed by a number of different people. Well, it's annoying, basically.
And then you've got to change all your passwords as well for things like email and...
Yeah, well, that's it. If you save passwords in your browser... Yeah. Which is very easy to do.
Every possible website, every forum you've ever been to. And,
exactly. So you have Facebook, Twitter, Identica, whatever. WordPress blog, something like that. That's all out there because you can go into Firefox Preferences Security, show passwords, and they're all there in plain text.
If somebody can get into your home.
And the thing is, even if you have, everyone has a password on their account when you actually log in. So you type in your name, Dave, and then type in your password. Do you think, that's actually protected? But it's not.
No,
it's just a little boot with the live CD.
Don't even need a live CD. Just press escape. Down one line, press enter.
So, just having that really isn't enough. So really, why don't we ship encrypted by default?
Think about what it is. What exactly is the problem? What you're talking about is somebody targeting your laptop. For example, your company. If I wanted to get into all your company files and things, I would steal your laptop and get all your information off your laptop.
To be targeted. I mean, if someone picked up a laptop and went, that's handy.
We spoke about a sort of opportune thief. Mm. Saw your laptop, picked it up. They just want to sell it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter whether it's them.
It could be the person who eventually ends up with it who likes that data.
I mean, how many documents has the British Secret Services lost? And that's not for being targeted because, they don't have a big sign-up saying, I'm MI5.
I think that's slightly different.
And people have come across
national security stuff.
No, but that's data. It's data. It doesn't matter whose it is. It's data.
And people obviously looking at the data they find lying on laptops or things they find lying on trains and they're taking the time to go through it and say, is this just somebody's random pictures or is this something more of national importance? The point is they're actually looking at it, not just wiping it.
Because they know that things like files left on trains and laptops left on trains and stuff are valuable to them. Not valuable to them in terms of them finding out secrets, but valuable to them and then they could pass them on to someone else and someone else might give them money for it. Yeah. So I don't think it's fair to say that you should worry about people targeting you. I think you should always worry about anyone because you never know where that laptop will end up. And the fact that this guy, his laptop, actually ended up with a friend of his, that could have been an enemy of his.
Yeah, sure.
Well, yeah. I mean, if we actually look for software to actually... we've looked at that. So if we move on to perhaps potentially finding your laptop.
Getting it back.
Yeah. So, that was by luck because it went through someone. Mm. But there are some, the other guy, he was basically effectively checking into a server and he could check the IP address.
Yeah, it wasn't actually a service that was for recovering laptops, but it just so happened that he could get data out.
But there are specific programs that do that, aren't there?
There's even some free software ones.
Yeah. Free as in...
Free as in free. Completely free.
Free as in
the capital F.
Capital F
and cost.
And lowercase F. Yes. Both
yes.
Fs.
Yes.
Little and big. Okay, and they ping a server on the net?
They all work differently, really.
Right.
There's a few.
There's one I come across, which I quite like, where you basically install this very simple application, and what it does is, every so often, it will check any website you want for a single text file that you put there, and you effectively mark that as missing, and then suddenly, when that happens, it goes into panic mode. Yeah?
No, rewind. When the software checks for a file on a web server that you control...
Yes.
And if the laptop is then stolen, you create that file because the fact that it's not there, it's nothing.
So you create it.
You create the file because you know your laptop's been stolen. Right. So it's your way of telling the laptop you've been stolen.
Yeah.
And then the laptop does what?
Well, the laptop, will send an email and send some other information, but also it can activate the webcam. Yeah. Now, this is really good. So it takes your picture. Now, nice. I actually heard one story about this where, I mean, this is cross-platform free software, yeah? Now, apparently on the Mac, whenever you activate the webcam, it will give you a countdown. Yeah.
Right.
So the thief has got it connected to the internet, and he can see the countdown. So he's working what's going to happen on the Mac. So he covers his face, but apparently doesn't do it quite in time.
Oh, that's a shame.
And they worked out who it was. It was a friend of a friend that was around someone's house about a year earlier. So they recognised the person.
The problem is, if I think about my laptop and what's going to happen to it if someone else takes it, assuming that I installed that software and every so often it's pinging my website, okay, when someone steals my laptop, they've got to get it online somehow. Or no, it has to get itself online somehow to get to my website. Now, if you open my laptop up, it's going to ask you for a username and password. Now, okay, let's say they're Linux savvy, and they're not going to go, well, see, what they might do is just go, what the hell is this? Put a Windows CD in.
Yeah.
Okay, and they might wipe it. Or they might think, oh, okay, I can hack this. And they look up online how to hack passwords on Ubuntu, and they figure out how to change my password, and then they log in as me, okay? At that point, they then have to actually go online. Because Network Manager isn't going to know, unless they plug it into the Ethernet cable.
Yeah, which is automatic. Then.
Which would be automatic, and then it would go ping, and the software would activate, take a photo, and all that. And if they're on a wireless network, it's not going to do it, unless they actually try.
I mean, the other thing is with laptops, why manufacturers aren't doing it more, it seems so logical to have a 3G or cellular network.
Mine does.
Exactly. Built in.
It doesn't work.
Well, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Aside from the fact it doesn't work in Linux.
But what we could do is do that whole process as part of the bootloader. So before they even know they're on an alternative operating system, it's already checked in, and then it started going into, I'm going to track you down mode.
Yeah.
And then starts recursively deleting all your data.
Well, actually, you could do it the other way around. You send a text message to your phone to say you've been stolen.
And then as soon as it's switched on, it would then receive the text message and perform the action.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
Excellent.
But I mean, the thing is, only a very small amount of laptops actually ship with them.
Well, more these days.
It's going to get better. Yeah. And to be honest, I think that's a much better solution because it will happen automatically.
You could wake on LAN over it, actually. Wake yourself up and delete yourself.
It's not bad. I actually... Sorry.
You've done that.
No, I actually...
woke up and deleted himself in the morning.
In a server, I actually started writing a program to have a shell over SMS. So if you press enter, it sends a text message, and then any response comes back as a text message.
Well, it could be useful in an emergency, I guess, but anyway.
It was just an experience, but anyway.
When you need emergency IRC. We've had some thoughts from our listeners on Twitter and Identica about this. JW Talbot says that he or she, I'm not sure which it is, would just cry if they lost their laptop.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, that's the first step. Big Fletch says that he hopes the person that stole it is a Windows user and is totally confused by Linux, so can't work out how to use it.
And then would format it.
Yeah, hang on, that's not spreading usability, though, is it? We want to encourage more Ubuntu users.
Steal my laptop and learn Linux. Absolutely. It's a bit of an expensive way to distribute. We could just give them a CD.
A CD is cheaper, yeah. Dorbers says, full disk encryption, noted down the serial numbers. That's worth doing.
I don't do that.
Yeah.
Right, now we know who to target.
Yeah.
I do.
I'm in ThinkPad. Get Dave's laptop.
Personalise the lid, which pretty much everybody here has done in some respect or the other. If it was stolen, the data is backed up safely, which again is sensible. Lake54 says biometrics and fingerprints are the most commonly used, besides passwords, ways of stopping people getting in. That's the fingerprint thing that you get on a lot of more and more netbooks and notebooks these days. Iris recognition is also making an appearance, although he does then correct that to say face recognition rather than iris recognition. Not quite got high def enough cameras in laptops at the moment. Lopter says, use the laptop as a graphical terminal. If it's lost or stolen or damaged, no data is lost, which is a good call.
So leave all your stuff in the cloud.
Yeah, especially SSH or something, and do it all there.
The cloud.
Well, particularly for netbooks, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, totally.
Nightwise says, never save your data locally, always work in the cloud, encrypt your remaining data. I would be annoyed, he says.
Putting it mildly.
If his laptop was stolen. And I think that's pretty much it, although some people are commenting about the frog we found in the studio earlier.
I see. That's quite a good point about your
the
hardware.
Frog?
I don't know, not the frog. I actually wouldn't be too bothered if people stole my hardware because I've got clunky old laptops. I mean, my newest piece of kit is my Asus 701. And if somebody nicked that, well, you know, yeah, okay.
Mm. But for some people, they rely on it.
Yeah,
you know.
Sure. But if we're going to talk about whole disk encryption or home folder encryption directory, I said folder. Shoot me now.
It's called folder in a month.
Yeah. What sort of performance issues are you looking at? Is it going to slow the whole system down?
It does. It does slow you down a bit. Less so if you're only doing home, because obviously then the whole operating system is not encrypted.
Yep.
But yeah, there is an impact, but.
Using full disk encryption, you're mounting it under a loopback. For the technical people out there, it's an LVM. But to me, a lot of people use an LVM like that in a similar way anyway. So the actual performance loss is so small, it's not even worth mentioning.
I don't think it is. I think there is a significant, because it's CPU time to decrypt it on the fly. It's still so. It's not just a volume. There's computational overhead to decrypt.
Okay, but anyway.
Anyone knows exactly what that is, what that computational overhead is, then let us know in numbers.
Yeah, and if you've got any tips or advice about securing your laptops or what you do or clever things to find them after they have been nicked, let us know at the usual address.
The Linux Unified Kernel Project has made 0.24 release. This project aims to add native support for Windows system calls to the Linux kernel. Bonkers, making it possible to run unmodified applications for both platforms on the same system. If that sounds like a lot of hard work and a little crazy, it probably is.
Yeah, it's a beta stage, I think, at the moment, really. You can't do very much with it.
Bonkers. Yeah. I think they take code from Wine and Reactos.
Yes.
And mix it up a little bit with Linux.
Sounds like a crazy thing to do on a Saturday night when you've not got anything better to do with
it. But actually, you can see why it would be useful.
Oh, brilliant, if it works.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Wine's only just hit 1.0 after 10 years of release. Reactos has been going 6 years or something and is slowly getting somewhere. Is it going to come to fruition?
I don't know. Yeah. It's worth watching, though.
We mentioned the beta last episode, but VirtualBox version 3 has been released properly. New features include improved support for webcams, OpenGL support for Windows, Linux and Solaris guests, and support for up to 32 virtual CPUs.
Wow. Yeah, that whole OpenGL stuff. It works.
I don't have anything that can run it.
Nothing that can run VirtualBox?
No.
Oh, bless.
Identica, the open source microblogging platform, is 1 year old.
Congratulations.
Yay. Yay.
Apparently, it's close to 6 million dents as well.
Wow. I saw on the blog post about this that Evan, who sort of was the creator of Identica, said that they had 10,000 users within the first 30 hours of starting it. 10,000 in 30 hours, that's ridiculous. And he had to switch hosting providers and everything.
Yeah, I think that was... I'm not knocking it or taking anything away from the work that Evan's done, because we all use Identica and it's great. But you have to remember that at that time, Twitter was really going down the pan in terms of performance. And that's one of the drivers behind people going, you know, towards Identica was because Twitter was rubbish at the time.
I don't agree with you. I think the main reason is because we plugged Identica when it first came out. And I reckon I reckon 1 in 10 of our listeners went and tried it. And then that adds up to...
Yeah, 10,000 in 30 hours. Yeah.
Yeah.
The release of the open source code for Launchpad, the system used to track bugs in Ubuntu and other projects, has been delayed. Originally announced as the 21st of July, it's now expected late July or maybe early August. It doesn't say which August. this is apparently to give time to test the new version of Bazaar, which will be used to host the code.
I'm not being funny, yeah? But I don't care about the new Bazaar. They've just put it in a big directory and say, you know, recursive wget.
But Bazaar's integral to Launchpad.
Yeah.
So you have to have them both.
Why?
Because that's the way they want to do it.
I mean, to me, it's...
Sorry, mate, converted. Absolutely. Bring them out together. Good point. Good delay.
Wow. Blimey. All we got to do is convert Tony and we're there.
K-Splice UpTrack is a new service that lets you effortlessly keep your systems up to date and secure without rebooting. The K-Splice technology allows a running kernel to be patched, and UpTrack provides a GUI front end to manage it. This is really quite clever. You can patch your kernel while it's running without rebooting.
I remember checking out a previous version of a similar task, and it did take out for like a nanosecond. There was basically nothing running.
Oh yeah, but it doesn't have. You don't have to power down the whole system and reboot it, which takes a minute at best.
Yeah.
Everyone I've mentioned this to, and I've pasted this URL in their announcement in a few IRC channels and places. The key word that comes out from everyone is scary.
Yeah, I can see why.
So it's called K-Splice. So does that mean we'll get a GNOME equivalent rather than just the KD version?
G-Splice.
LNX have launched a 6-inch ebook reader for £189, available through the Borders UK website. Sort of. At the time of recording, we couldn't actually find it anywhere on the Borders website.
Yeah. You look at ebook or LNX and you find like loads of wacky books, but not a book reader.
Do you know, I think they're lying about the 6 inches. I reckon it's probably going to be a bit smaller and that's why you couldn't see it.
The people at starryhope.com have investigated the popularity of different Linux distros. They report that people are blogging about Ubuntu far more often than other distros. We'd also like to note that a good amount of blog posts that contain the word Fedora are about the hat and not the Linux distro.
Excellent.
According to some stats, Ubuntu is more popular now than ever.
Yeah, there's loads of graphs where they've like compared. You know that Google compare-y thing where you can
Google
see...
Google Trends.
That's the one. I call it Google compare-y thing, but that will do.
They were going to go with that name for a while.
Damn. And it shows you like comparatively how popular certain search terms are when they were comparing Ubuntu and Fedora, Ubuntu and Red Hat. And,
so is that actually saying Ubuntu is more popular or more people need to search for help for Ubuntu than other distributions?
Quite possibly.
Yeah.
Good point.
Open Source Schools Unconference at NCSL's Conference Centre in Nottingham on the Monday the 20th of July.
Six people have now said they want to come and see my talk.
Are you talking at that?
Yeah, that's the one I'm talking at.
Oh.
There's like a dig thing for voting up talks, and six people say they want to.
And how many people digged it down?
So is that Laura, Dave, Simon, me, you, and the frog?
Yeah, that's right, the frog.
And the studio cat.
Software Freedom Day is on Saturday the 19th of September 2009 this year.
Atlanta Linux Fest, also the 19th of September 2009 at the IBM facility on Northside Parkway.
The Ubuntu Global Jam is on the 2nd to the 4th of October 2009.
All around the world.
Get involved.
Covered in jam.
Lug Radio Live 2009, 24th of October, Newham Arts Centre. Did you see how I ignored him there?
Yeah.
Wolverhampton. Our mailbag was absolutely full with an email. About command line foo.
We had a few. It was good to see. I was quite chuffed, actually.
Yeah, good.
Couple
so
of
you've got another one, haven't you?
Yeah. This has been prompted by Andy Stanford Clark's Twittering House, which has been all over the web over the last week or so.
He even made it into the Daily Mail.
Impressive.
And the BBC's website. Yeah.
I'm not overly impressed there, Tony.
Basically, his house sends tweets. I'm not too sure if he uses Identica. But it's irrelevant, about certain things that are going on within his house. Various power things and temperatures and stuff. Anyway, how on earth does he do that, bearing in mind that all the clients that we see are sort of GUIs? Well, you can do it from the command line. And I'm not going to read them out this week after last week because that was horrible. So go and have a look at the website. And essentially, there are two command lines that you can use, one for Twitter and one for Identica, to tweet your message.
And it's curl, isn't it?
That's really quite fun. I mean, you can set up all sorts of automated things, little scripts to basically tweet or dent whatever you want. It could be, I don't know, when my kids get home from school and power up their laptops, they could tweet that they've come online they're on the internet rather than when they pop up on MSN Messenger.
I mean, you could hook it into almost anything when your print job was completed or... anything that's scriptable.
Yeah. It's quite spooky, actually, because the other day I was at work and one of the IT systems I've been, the Windows guys, looked over at me and he goes, "Have you ever heard of something called curl?" I was like, "Yeah." Well, funnily enough, I have, yes.
I mean, the other thing you could do is you could also, say, attach it to maybe an external microprocessor unit with input and output digital, and then you could connect it to the toilet, and every time you flush the toilet, it could then dent or tweet as well.
Indeed.
If only there was such a device.
Mm.
There are a few concerns, though.
Moving on.
There are a few concerns. For example, obviously, if you're typing on the command line, it gets saved in your bash history. And if you put your username and password on the command line, it will be saved in your bash history. Somebody could compromise your machine, go in and see your password.
Well, you need to encrypt your home directory to do that, don't
yes.
you?
Or not use username and passwords, use OAuth. But anyway, go on, carry on, Tony.
OAuth? Okay, well, that was my question, really. Is there anything that you can do to stop...
Apparently, if you drop a space at the beginning of the command, so space, curl, and all the rest of it, then that doesn't get saved into your bash history.
Uh-huh. I didn't know that.
Apparently. I've tried it, and it's right. It does work.
That's very cunning. I did actually find...
That is two tips for the price of one.
Yes. Hey, no, we'll spice that out and put that in next week's.
Spread the quality thin. There's another thing which people can try if they want to tweet from the command line, which is an IRC tweet gateway.
TWRC.
It's called TWRC, which I've tried a bit, and it's a little bit clunky, but if it's the only way you can get to it, then give that
That's
a
more
go.
Of an interactive thing, though,
it's
isn't
it? It's more interactive, yeah. But yeah, that about wraps up your ways to interact with Twitter.
Thank you, Simon.
A pleasure. Right, I'm a lover of little gadgets and computers. Laura's been sent a great little kit to have a look at. Tell us about the Arduino, Laura.
It's an Arduino. It's an open source hardware electronics board, and the idea is that it will help you prototype electronic projects by just plugging things into it without having to understand all the little bits of things that I don't understand in terms of electronics.
So you don't need a degree in electronics to do it?
No. And you don't need to open you don't need to get out your soldering iron or anything like that either.
So it's a pre-built board, and you can plug it into a computer, pump software into it, and make it do things.
Yeah, and because it's open source hardware, you can get the spec online, and you can build it yourself from components that you could buy anywhere, or you can buy the actual board itself pre-assembled.
So you probably have to get your soldering iron out to build the board yourself if you need to.
Yeah, if you wanted to do that bit. But I didn't. I bought it.
Okay, and how much was it?
I think the boards themselves are around about £20. I got the beginner's kit that comes with lots of little bits of LEDs and resistors and things. I didn't know what they were.
And do you know now?
I do.
Right, okay. So you've got the board. You've got all the little bits of things that are LEDs mm-hmm. and resistors. What do you do with it?
Mostly I've just made LEDs flash. I've got the O'Reilly Getting Started book, and that... It's pretty good, actually. It literally is a little book, and it goes through the very sort of basics, not just about Arduino, but about tinkering with electronics and how you can hack things and sort of trying to get you into the whole culture of hacking hardware.
To what end?
Just for fun.
Well, like making LEDs flash.
But making LEDs flash is essentially switching stuff on and off, isn't it? So you can probably do... Wow, limited by your imagination, I would expect.
It reminds me of, like, science project-type kits that I got as a kid. You know, like, I got, like...
Like the sort of 300-in-1 kits or something.
Oh, yeah. Bulbs. But this is, like, a step on, because it's not just, like, a bulb and a battery and a couple of wires. There's, you know, you can program it.
It's a bulb and a battery and a couple of wires. You
but there's a lot more wires.
And you can do all sorts of good funky stuff with it.
Yeah, but the difference is with them kits, you had to actually make it with different components, you know, using transistors and things like that. Whereas what you can do with this is you actually basically write a program in code to turn the light on and off rather than doing it
with a switch.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really focused on doing things with software, and the hardware's all pre-assembled ready for you to kind of support you doing that software.
But presumably you need to twiddle with the hardware quite a bit to plug in the LEDs or the speakers or the sensors or whatever it is you're doing.
Yeah, and you have the Arduino board, and then you have this plastic breadboard on the side, which has got loads of little holes in it and connectors and things, so that you can just poke LEDs or, all the cables and things in the right place and hook everything up together without having to actually twist wires together or anything like that, which you could do if you wanted otherwise.
And I guess it's not just limited to LEDs and stuff and switches. You can add sensors in there and
stuff like accelerometers or light sensors.
Yeah, like, I mean, you've got a light here that, you know, comes on at night. It fascinates me every time I come here. But, you know, it's just a solar panel. I mean, you could do the same kind of thing, but you could have it more intelligent, you know, switches on when you're here and off when you're on holiday and stuff like that, because you can program it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking about Andy's Twittering house before, and it's that kind of thing. It's bringing kind of real-world stuff into computing, and it's that connecting point between the two worlds.
So you could have a sensor that then set off a process that sent a tweet message like Andy's done?
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you program in? What language?
There's a little IDE you can get, you download from Arduino itself, and you write little scripts, something like that, isn't it? And that's called a processing language, but it's actually based on something like Java. But it's very sort of simplified, and the book itself talks you through it and building up what you need to do with it.
Would you say you need to be like, you know, a serious programmer type to get into this, or do you think this would be suitable as like a present for someone like a kid, maybe like, you know, 14, 13, maybe younger, who's interested in like this kind of stuff, you know, like creative stuff, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, if they're into that kind of thing, I'm not a programmer at all, but I did a little bit of programming when I was probably about that kind of age, actually. And it really does lead you through. It gives you all the examples and then talks you through what each bit of it does.
Do you know if there's much of a community around it at all?
I don't know, but I guess there probably is.
I've had a look. There is quite a bit of community, and there is on the Arduino website, there's a list of examples of some of the projects and some of the things that you can do. I have to say, looking at it, on the Arduino site, it's all, shall we say, art-based stuff. But there's some really, really cool stuff going on. So there's lots of lights, there's lots of pictures. The one that really grabbed my attention was it was a shop front. And they were using the Arduino to display words and things on the actual shop front, which is glass, as people walk past. Just from this tiny little sort of 3-inch by 3-inch board.
There is actually one really interesting project I come across, and that's using it's actually a modification because it's an open platform. So people have made a custom one, and that's where it's an autopilot system for actually flying a remote control aeroplane. Now that to me is really cool.
So that's almost an embedded application, really, isn't it?
Well, that's essentially what this box is.
Yeah.
An embedded motherboard.
And you can get Arduino boards that are custom made so that they're really small and you can sew them into clothing. So you can have, like, brooches that flash or whatever.
But you say you've programmed your board. How can it run independently?
You load the sketch onto the board. It's called a sketch, not a script. Load the sketch from your computer over USB to the board. Yeah. And then once it's there, it'll just run continuously until you overwrite it.
So has it got a battery or something?
That's a good question.
No, I mean, you can
haven't
power
got
it,
that far.
You can power it by USB, or there's a power socket for attaching like a plug-in power supply or battery.
So you could get like, you know, a 9-volt battery or something and run it.
Yeah, I think the clothing ones use like watch battery type batteries.
Oh, okay, so something quite small then.
I haven't seen one in person, but I'm told they're very small, the lily pad ones.
Okay, I saw on their website that there are training courses and things. So there must be quite a community of people interested in this sort of hardware hacking. I know that Abe Bradshaw, former Lug Radio presenter, Abe Bradshaw, went for an Arduino weekend.
He was very excited about that.
Yeah, a little bit too excited, I think. So there's obviously, you know, say, quite a few people who are interested in building up little weird projects and things with this. Have you got any sort of particular projects in mind?
No, well, I got a book for Christmas, another O'Reilly one, making things talk.
Making things talk to your computer, essentially, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and it was a bigger book about the same kind of idea, and it talks about using Arduino as the example for it. And that does things like you've got a mat with a cat on it, and when the cat lies on the mat, it'll send you an email. I mean, it's quite useless, that, but it's the kind of thing, and it's sort of coming back to the whole twittering house and mouse traps and stuff.
A lot of this comes down to the question that people often ask when you do anything with a computer or anything with a gadget is, why do you do that? And it's, you know, because you can, and it's fun.
Yeah.
It's a good laugh, and, you know, creating things to do something that scratch a personal itch is, you know, rewarding.
Yeah, I mean, several people I know and work with are into doing these kinds of things. So as much as anything, I just wanted to try and understand some of it.
One thing I did see was I've recently subscribed to Make, like, TV channel podcast type thing. I think it's actually a TV program in the States on some channels. And some of their programs actually feature the Arduino, and they have videos showing you how to wire it up and, you know, how to, and the code is available on their website and stuff. So, you know, it's quite mainstream, really. You know, it seems a bit geek and a bit niche, but it seems, you know, fairly mainstream.
Yeah, I think Make make people have got into it in a really big way, as I've seen it quite often.
I think the limiting factor is not really what it can do, it's what your imagination can do.
Definitely.
So, you know, I mean, it's actually hard to think up cool projects. I mean, one of the first projects I made was based on an example, and that was a traffic light system. So you press a button and the lights change, then it flashes, allow you to cross and things like that. Now, yeah, okay, that sounds really stupid, but the actual concept there is really cool. Now, the other thing they do is you can actually run a serial interface into it. So you can actually run it into your computer as well to send back commands and things like that. So you can have like event-driven stuff to, you know, I don't know, when the toilet flushes, you could make it so it sends a command to your computer to tweet.
I've got an obsession about that. It's like second time tonight that's come up.
It's like the office chair that tweets whenever the guy sits and it farts.
Laura, we can't have that sort of language on our podcast.
Apparently, I'm sorry, I'm only a guest presenter.
Apparently it's all right to talk about a tweeting toilet there.
So the book itself... does what you were saying, it kind of...
Getting started book.
The getting started book, it'll take you through, and as you say, the traffic light thing isn't especially useful necessarily, but it kind of, it's an example of what you can do with it. And the whole thing about it using LEDs in the book for the examples is it's stepping you through and showing you what the different sketches can do and what you, and sort of how electronics needs to be controlled to make things happen.
Cowjuice tweeted us to tell us that he bought an Arduino board with an SD card header.
Ooh.
So presumably he can program stuff, put his programs on his SD card, connect it up, and with thermistors, I guess, so he can do temperature-related controlling, which would be really good if you could get it to open the window if it got too hot or something. Okay, so it sounds like you've had a bit of fun working on this, and I know Dave has got one of these boards that he's used in the past as well. The good people at tinker.it have offered to give us an Arduino board to give away. It's an Arduino Duemilanovi. I almost certainly didn't say that correctly. 328. Apparently that's the new board, basically, that's just about to come out. They offered to give us one of those. And we've also got a copy of the O'Reilly book, Getting Started with Arduino, to give away.
And the question is, there are some Arduino tutorials on the tinker.it website. How much does the equipment for the RFID tutorial cost?
And the answers are A, £3.50, B, £35.49, C, £350, or D, Fred Perry in 1936.
Email your answer and address to competition at ubuntu-uk.org. Closing date is the 19th of July. And good old tinker.it, we're going to ship this anywhere.
To the moon.
And thanks to listener Nicole Leary for putting us in touch with Tinker.
Ah, thanks, Nick. Well, good luck, everybody. This week, Alan Bell alerted us to XPRA, which enables persistent remote graphical applications. Basically, it's a bit like Screen for GUIs, which you can disconnect and reconnect to graphical applications without stopping them running.
So you could move from one, you could like be at work, connect to a server and run some application and then go, oh, I need to go home, close your machine down.
Yeah.
And then go home and from a completely different machine, connect to the same thing and carry on running.
Yeah. So it's not like VNC and RDP, which actually provide you with a whole desktop remotely. Mm-hmm. This is for a single application. Apparently, it's a bit like a program called XMove, which it does similar thing, but never really kind of worked.
See, this is like out of 24, when they say, send that to my screen. Yeah. I love that, to be able to just like click on something and then throw it at somebody else's screen. That would be really cool.
You don't physically throw it?
No, you do. That would be really cool to like grab hold of the window and throw it across the screen, and it disappears off the top of the screen and lands on someone else's screen.
But the thing is, what if not a very good shot and it hits someone in the face?
Then even better.
We finally found a reason for wobbling.
Anyway,
that's right.
I can dream.
George Castro writes in his blog about the relaunch of AppZeroConf. He says, on your home machine, you check a box in a GUI someplace, and then all the machines share their packages with each other, which means that on release day you upgrade one machine, and then when you upgrade the others you don't have to re-download everything again. Combine this with Deb Delta syncing and you've got a nice little bandwidth saving solution.
Okay, so yeah. This is a bit like apt mirror or apt proxy. Well,
not
it?
Quite. No, it's like, you know, using a proxy, a caching proxy, but apt mirror, you're downloading the whole archive.
Well, the nice thing about this is I could be, for example, at work where I've got a nice connection, and on my laptop upgrade all the packages and then take that laptop home and it magically shares those out with everyone on my network.
But also, whilst you're at your workplace, if I was also happen to be at your workplace, yep,
that would share with those as well.
Even though you don't actually know me, if you like, then you know we could be sharing across the network. That is pretty sweet.
I could even share on the train on the way home with other people.
I'd be interested to know if anybody connected to your apt cache or your apt zero.
I've told you about the time that I used Bonjour on a train. It's the same thing. Bonjour is zero. Yeah, so there is an opportunity for you to connect to someone else in an ad hoc situation and share packages. It's really cool.
Alan Lord has written about the fact that you can run Firefox 3.5 on Ubuntu 9.04, but it's quite fiddly.
At the moment, yeah. I think it's going to, once, I think the focus was getting it into Karmic, which will be 9.10, and then backporting it back to the previous releases.
Yeah. I mean, he talks about downloading the package, you know, downloading the actual archive. Yeah,
the TAR file.
Yeah, and actually installing it that way. Oh, right. Now, what I can understand is there is at least one PPA with it in now. But we did really miss the boat there, because that should have been ready pretty much on release day to say, hey, you know, here it is. I mean, because there was clearly such a demand for wanting to try Firefox 3.5. I guess, you know, I can complain, maybe I should have done that.
When did it come out?
Yeah.
Was it 2 days ago?
Yeah, and his blog post is dated 2 days ago.
He got it
on time.
Yeah, exactly. So he actually downloaded the actual tar.
We should have been ready with it in the archive.
We should have, with the package.
As a backport, I guess, yeah.
Well, no, even as an unofficial one. And I guess, I can say that, but, I didn't step up to the plate. No one in this room did, so I can't really moan that much, I suppose.
Right, yeah, nice, shut up, mate. Dave. Dustin Kirkland wrote on the Ubuntu Devil mailing list, a call for testing KVM version 84, which is a new version of the KVM virtualization software that's in the Linux kernel. And the reason why he asked for this is because they're looking to backport the newer version of KVM back to Dapper, I think it is, which is 6.06. And,
wow.
Is that...
Why bother? I mean, people have been using Dapper for that amount of time.
5 years on the server, so it's still got a while to go.
It's still supported.
The thing is, KVM wasn't on Dapper, was it? As far as I know.
No.
So you shouldn't backport it.
Yeah, so basically, people who've been using Dapper 2 now, why would they want to add virtualization functionality?
I think they... not Dapper, Hardy.
Oh, that's different. That's different.
Sorry, my mistake.
Suddenly it all becomes clear.
Yeah, that does make sense.
Listener Lake54 posted us a link to a forum thread about whether Karmic is an off-putting name for a release, given the spiritual or religious meaning of the word Karmic.
I never thought that. Actually, I know there was a guy who used to hang around in the UK loco, whose name I shall mention for protecting his anonymity, and he didn't like the fact that Launchpad gave people karma. He didn't like that term.
Yeah.
The fact that you get points and they're called karma.
Yeah, it depends what connotations you attach to it. Is for example, if you look at the Ubuntu row, I totally disagreed with
Ubuntero.
Yeah. I mean, I totally disagreed with changing that because it was a new word coined essentially for Ubuntu.
No, it's not. It's an existing...
Yes, but in our language, it was ported.
If it's an international product, you can't just say, well, the word zub is okay in English.
It worked for 4 years before someone decided to raise a bug about it.
I quite like somebody in the forum said that essentially karma equates to Newton's third law of reciprocal actions anyway.
There's a few new things coming up in Karmic that I just thought we'd have a quick run through.
Go for it.
First one is kernel, and actually we were corrected, we got some feedback about this, we were corrected.
Oh, yeah, we did.
It's kernel 2.6.31 that's going to be in Karmic, which isn't actually out yet. So
clever.
Yeah, no, it's not released, we're a release candidate or something. There's a new logon screen and a new fast user switcher thing, you know, like the fast user switcher where you change user. That's changed.
Now, you were sort of pointing out perhaps coincidental similarities between the login screen and on the Karmic and the one that happens to be on your Mac OS X system.
Yes, it's uncannily similar.
I'm sure it's just a coincidence.
Yes. So are you telling me we actually have the login screen that actually comes with the version of GNOME release to actually match?
I don't know.
Oh, because the one in Jaunty's is the 2.6. GDM's an older version.
They get it to... Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
There's a request for some server tips to go on the screen when you log on to a server and you get the boilerplate with
the message of the day.
Message of the day and
landscape
all the stuff.
Plug.
And the advertisements for Canonical pay-for services. There's a request to put some server tips on there. And the wiki has got a list of some of them. I actually put one on there and it got removed.
I saw that. But yours was a very good one.
Yeah, it was don't run with scissors.
Yeah, to me, when you're logging into a server...
Yeah.
There's things on the wiki about Vert.io, making your virtualization faster, how to get in touch with the server team, power management tools, Biobu, which is what Simon's been tweaking, and Ubuntu Enterprise Cloud, which is another product.
And finally, there's only a few days left for you to enter the Ubuntu Free Culture Showcase. I think it closes about the 16th of July, isn't it?
Quite early this time, isn't it?
Yeah, there's not a lot of time left. So there's a good few contributions there already.
Yeah.
Some photos, a bit of music, and a couple of videos. But if you want to contribute, then we'll put a link to the wiki in the show notes.
It's time for your feedback, and Alistair Monroe has dented that he submitted a paper cut recently, and although it was rejected, it was bounced to an appropriate place, and the experience didn't put him off, which is good, because we talked about the paper cuts in the last episode.
Yeah, that's good.
The first round has gone through, actually, and a load of them have been fixed. Some of them have been bumped to the next round.
Oh, right.
But a lot of them have been fixed.
So yeah. 100 sort of annoying little problems that wouldn't otherwise get these.
Well over 100, but yes.
Elblog blogged saying that he found the Ubuntu User Magazine in Trondheim.
Trondheim.
Okay. Airport, having heard about it on the show, but he had to pay £19 for it instead of £7.
Yeah.
Wow.
A lot of people in foreign have to pay over the odds. Like, if you get a magazine from America over here, it's ridiculous.
Hang on, I had like a whole box of them Ubuntu magazines. I could have sold them for £19 a pop.
If you went to Trondheim Airport, yeah.
You could undercut it, actually.
How much is your budget airline entry?
Wow.
I should have done that.
There's a money-making scheme in the making there.
Yeah.
Nandan told us that one upcoming feature in Ubuntu Karmic you missed in the podcast is KMS, which works very well, even on the Jaunty with a newer kernel. What's KMS then?
Kernel mode switching. It gives you, it turns the graphics, turns the display into a graphical mode very early on in the boot process, so that you don't get that flickering that you get from going from the splash screen to GDM, from GDM to your logon.
Is it that brings us the Plymouth love?
Well, we're not having Plymouth specifically, but that kind of love, yeah. David emailed in to say, Kernel 2.6, this is the one, see, I'm a throwback to the...
Yeah.
Nice.
David emailed in to say, Kernel 2.6.31 is actually being in Karmic, not 2.6.30, as strongly implied in the five best things in 2.6.30 segment, when we did, you did that awful pop quiz
that you wrote. And I think we actually mentioned when we talked about the alpha, which was out, which has obviously got a kernel that exists, not one that is yet to be released at some point.
They shouldn't have done that. They should have just missed it out.
Yeah, go for imaginary kernel.
A couple of other features that David pointed out was Banshee may replace Rhythmbox in time for 9.10 if certain blockers are removed. And there should be a new program. I'm not sure if this is a wish list or whether he's actually saying this does exist.
I think he's saying there should be a new program.
Yeah, there should be. But that could be interpreted as it should be ready.
Yes, it should be ready if it all goes well.
Well, there really should be.
Shall I explain it?
Yeah.
There should be a new program that combines the ease of use of add/remove programs and Update Manager and the advanced capabilities of Synaptic and Gdebi. So basically, mash them all together into one big app.
Another big GUI package management tool.
Yeah, we need another package manager.
Yeah, they're calling it Aptitude.
Laura emailed in. Producer Laura, this is, emailed in. She did actually email into the show.
She did, didn't she? Yeah.
She lost her voice. To say that the BBC News piece about Andy Stanford Clark's Twittering house that we talked about earlier was in the shot of his web browser that they had on the BBC News. You can see that he's using Ubuntu.
Yeah.
And Firefox, obviously. And apparently you also got a glimpse of his Vigilant MPCL.
Yeah, that's good.
Oh, yes, you did. Yeah, it was on the windowsill.
Yeah.
Cool.
Ian Pascoe asks about upgrading the Vigilant MPCL to 9.04. He says, from reading Alan's and the other blogs, it isn't really straightforward matter of just getting the live media booting and going.
Yeah.
It pretty much is. I found you still had to have the kernel ACPI line.
You're upgrading or clean installing?
Both.
Didn't you have the problem that I reported a bug at the fact that the driver for the...
The RJ45 port?
No, the driver for the hard drive, the IDE controller, was missing in the kernel.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
it and I had to copy it across.
Jaunty?
Yeah. When I installed on mine, it wouldn't find the hard drives.
Okay, I didn't have that
problem. Is that fixed now?
Well, I installed 8.10 and upgraded to 9.04, including upgrading the kernel, and it didn't have that problem.
I think Alan used the imaginary kernel.
Yeah, right, okay. I had to have the ACPI tweak to turn ACPI off on boot for it to boot, and I had to disable the geode driver because that's still broken, even in Jaunty after about 3 releases, so that's the graphics chip driver. Fine with Visa, and I found out a little line that means it displays a reasonable scale on my big TV in my front room.
And for possibly the fifth plug in this show, Andy Stanford-Clark on his website does actually have quite a good rundown on some Vigeland tips, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He got those from our website.
Yeah, blatantly stole them. And that's about all your feedback for this show. Thank you.
Well, that was a fun-packed show, so let's wrap it up. So thanks for listening, and thanks to everyone who took part via Twitter and Identica. If you'd like to get hold of us, you can email the show via podcast at ubuntu-uk.org or leave 30 seconds of voicemail on 0845 508 1986.
You can send us your comments on Identica via identi.ca/UUPC or Twitter, which is twitter.com/UUPC, as well as getting updates from recording sessions.
Alternatively, if you're... I'm always reading this bit. Alternatively, if you're into IRC, you can chat to us via the #Ubuntu-UK channel on the free Node IRC network.
Join our Facebook fan page. Search for Ubuntu UK Podcast.
How many are we up to now?
137.
Wow, that's one up on last week.
We're about 960 odd on Twitter, though.
Anyway, we're going.
Sorry, Dave. Didn't mean to break your concentration.
We welcome suggestions, materials, tips, reviews, rants, and
so positive not rants
and negative. So please do get in touch.
Thanks also to our network of community mirrors listed on the website.
Yeah, thanks so much.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.